I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Liz Cheney, vice chair of the January 6th committee, made opening remarks at yesterday's seventh hearing, refuting the arguments that former President Trump had been duped by his advisors about the 2020 election and could not tell right from wrong.
President Trump is a 76-year-old man. He is not an impressionable child. Just like everyone else in our country, he is responsible for his own actions and his own choices. As our investigation has shown, Donald Trump had access to more detailed and specific information showing that the election was not actually stolen than almost any other American, and he was told this over and over again. No rational or sane man in his position could disregard that information and reach the opposite conclusion. And Donald Trump cannot escape responsibility by being willfully blind.
Cheney ended yesterday's hearing claiming that Trump tried to contact a witness who told their lawyer, who told the committee, that referred the matter to the Justice Department, raising questions about witness tampering. In between, we learned that Trump was told multiple times by his White House advisors that there was no evidence of fraud, but he went ahead falsely claiming that he had won the election. There was a late-night fight that devolved into a screaming match between his White House advisors and Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, Michael Flynn, and the CEO of Overstock over the federal government seizing ballot boxes. Powell believed that she had been named a special counsel with special powers. She is one of Trump's most ardent election deniers and conspiracy mongers. There was also testimony about how Trump's tweets, along with rally speeches by Alex Jones, Roger Stone, Michael Flynn, and others, revved up his supporters and members of extremist groups, including the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, who believed Trump's lies about a stolen election, telling them to come to the Capitol to disrupt the certification. And we know what happened next. Joining us is Andy Campbell, senior editor at Huffington Post, who covers extremism, author of a book that's coming out in September titled We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism. Andy Campbell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Hugo Lowell, congressional reporter covering January 6th for The Guardian. Hugo Lowell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me as well.
You're welcome. Andy, let me begin with you. We have a lot to talk about during this hour, to say the least. But what do you think is the major takeaway from yesterday's hearing, especially for a general public, people that haven't been, you know, watching it probably as carefully as you and Hugo and myself?
Right. Well, you know, one of the through lines and one of the big takeaways that the committee was trying to show was that Trump and everyone around him knew for a fact that there was no fraud taking place and that Trump insisted on going through with the big lie anyway, that there was some sort of fraud happening with the votes. And throughout the meeting, the committee showed that whenever Trump was told no or was told, hey, you know, we should probably admit that we lost this election, he made those people leave the room and then filled the room with a number of yes men who are basically clowns. I mean, you had several conspiracy theorists in the room with him. You had the, you know, as you said, the former CEO of Overstock.com, a furniture salesman.
Of all people, right? Around.
Yeah, right. And so what they showed sort of generally was that Trump refused the no's around him and said to the public over and over, started, you know, ramping up his rhetoric around January 6th. This is going to be the last big fight for me. Everybody come out. And they really were successful in drawing that picture.
And Hugo, do you think the committee is getting closer to building their case that Trump's actions and, I guess, inactions led to the attack on the U.S. Capitol?
Yeah, I think on both fronts, right? I mean, the committee made a big point yesterday about how Trump's tweet the morning after that crazy 18th of December meeting in the Oval Office, how that tweet effectively was the clarion call for the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the Stop the Steal activists to put into motion what became their plans for January 6th. So I think that speaks to the action part. And then I think they're teeing it up quite nicely for the next hearing, when they're expected to talk about the 187 minutes of the Capitol attack and how Trump kind of sat in the White House watching the violence unfold on TV and then did nothing, which kind of speaks to the inaction part of that criminal obstruction of an official proceeding statute. And so by highlighting those two elements, they really made Trump at the center of that case. And I think it's a pretty effective argument.
Let me play a couple of clips. We'll start with the first clip. And Andy, I'll start with you. This is former Trump White House counsel Pat Cipollone. We actually got to hear some of his testimony from last Friday. And he's telling members about his response to this idea of having the government seize state voting machines. It's number four.
To have the federal government seize voting machines, that's a terrible idea for the country. That's not how we do things in the United States. There's no legal authority to do that. And there is a way to contest elections, you know, that happens all the time. But the idea that the federal government could come in and seize election machines, you know, I don't understand why we even have to tell you why that's a bad idea. It's a terrible idea.
He says it's a terrible idea. Andy, your thoughts about that idea? I mean, it didn't happen, obviously, but it was seriously considered at this meeting.
It seems to me that former President Trump had many authoritarian ideas that may or may not have gotten no's at the time, and yet he was willing to go that extra mile anyway. Whenever he was told no, he would sort of lash out on Twitter and announce, you know, we're going to do this ourselves if my people won't do it. And that's just what he did. I mean, you know, a day later, he tweets out, hey, everybody come down to the Capitol on January 6th, will be wild. And it absolutely set the extremist world on fire. There was, you know, immediately you had these far right podcasters and loudmouths just mobilizing their followings, like within, you know, 24 hours of that fateful meeting in the Oval Office, you had the entire extremist spectrum and everyday Republicans gearing up for what they saw as a civil war on January 6th.
Yeah. And Hugo, let me play another clip. And again, this is White House counsel, former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. And he's describing an exchange with lawyer Sidney Powell, in which he listed several claims like corrupt judges in 60 lawsuits contesting the results of the 2020 election. Let's play that number three and we'll talk about it.
We were pushing back and we were asking one simple question as a general matter. Where is the evidence? So,
what response did you get when you asked Ms. Powell and her colleagues where's the
evidence? A variety of responses based on my current recollection, including, can't believe you would say something, you know, things like this, like, what do you mean, where's the evidence? You should know, you know, and things like that, or a disregard, I would say, a general disregard for the importance of actually backing up what you say with facts.
And Hugo, there were 61 lawsuits filed as a result of the election. 60 were tossed out of court, and Sidney Powell was kind of at the center of a lot of these challenges. Can you speak to that? And it should be said that she is being sued, or was being sued, in federal court. Dominion Voting Machines is suing her as well. And she said, no reasonable person would conclude my statements were statements of fact. How are we supposed to understand her and the kind of power she seems to have over Donald Trump?
I think the failed lawsuits are a really good point, because it kind of sets the scene before Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne and Trump's former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, show up at the White House, right? They've lost lawsuit after lawsuit. Trump really has no real avenue left to try and overturn the election apart from, you know, either focusing on January 6th or some sort of other far-fetched strategy. And it's at that White House meeting that Sidney Powell presents him a far-fetched strategy, and he seriously considers it, right? I mean, this whole thing about seizing the voting machines, using the National Guard to seize it. Like, there were several draft versions of a executive order and memoranda that she brought with her. One of them suggested having the National Guard seize voting machines. Another one was like, you know, the DOD can seize voting machines. And the crucial point was that she wanted to be appointed special counsel to investigate election fraud. And she said Trump, sorry, and she
no,
just
no,
said
go ahead, go
that
ahead.
Trump had authority to do this because of this underlying executive order, which we don't even think is legal potentially, And so she came in armed with all of this and tried to make this impression on Trump, who was already desperate.
I mean, Andy, how close do you think we came to having voting machines seized?
I have no doubt that we came close to Trump trying directly, because, you know, over the years, there have been a number of just completely authoritarian moves that he's made. I remember during the BLM protests of 2020 when Trump had federal troops go in to cities where there were overwhelmingly peaceful protests happening, and he would have federal troops disappear protesters in the street. I mean, we are not far from this fascist slide at any moment when this guy is standing in the White House.
And to you, Hugo, there was then, and timing, I think what we learned yesterday in part was that the timing does matter. So after this meeting at about 1:45 in the morning, Trump tweets out this tweet telling people to come to D.C. How important is that?
It's really important because you have to think about what happened in those intervening hours before the conclusion of that meeting and him sending the tweet. And it sounds like, based on our reporting and our sources, that the Select Committee and the Justice Department, in fact, is trying to establish whether or not that tweet came as a bit of an addendum to that meeting, where it was, you know, one of Sidney Powell or one of Mike Flynn suggesting to Trump that, you know, this isn't going to work, we need to focus on January 6th, or if it was Trump himself deciding that the plan to seize voting machines was without merit and was not a particularly strong strategy, and therefore himself shifted his focus to the congressional certification. But either way, that's really key because it gives us an insight into what he was thinking and could speak to the mens rea part of a potential crime if this is ever prosecuted.
And Andy, you cover extremist groups. How did they read that tweet?
Well, they read that tweet as their mobilization, and certainly the Proud Boys and other extremist groups said that they were getting ready for war after that. Certainly, this has happened a number of times, including during the presidential debates when, even before Trump lost, when he said, you know, stand back, stand by, Proud Boys. These are taken as marching orders for these extremist groups who were amassing. They were amassing equipment. They were amassing money. They were getting tickets for their friends and followers to descend on January 6th. And so really, when you got to January 6th, by the time we were there, the thousands of people that were there were just full of these violent extremists who believed that they were going to battle that day.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We've got a lot more clips as well to play. That's Andy Campbell, senior editor at Huffington Post, covering extremism. He's got a book coming out in September called We Are Proud Boys. Hugo Lowell is with us as well, congressional reporter covering January 6th for The Guardian. We're talking about yesterday's hearing. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Almost forgot where I work. Talking with Hugo Lowell. He's congressional reporter for The Guardian. Also with us, Andy Campbell, senior editor at Huffington Post. And we are talking about yesterday's hearing held by the January 6th committee. It was their seventh hearing. They have another one scheduled for next week, next Thursday evening. We learned a lot, and we have some more clips to play, including a montage, and this is after Trump's December 19th tweet telling people to come to Washington, D.C. It's going to be wild. A number of websites were created and people started to organize, and a number of far-right media personalities promoted the date, and here's a montage presented by the committee.
President Trump, in the early morning hours today, tweeted that he wants the American people to march on Washington, D.C. on January 6, 2021.
And now Donald Trump, is calling on his supporters to descend on Washington, D.C., January 6th.
He is now calling on we, the people, to take action and to show our numbers.
We're going to only be saved by millions of Americans moving to Washington, occupying the entire area, if necessary, storming right into the Capitol. If you have enough people, you can push down any kind of a fence or a wall.
You better understand something, son. You better understand something. Red wave, red wave. This is going to be a red wedding going down January 6th.
On that day, Trump says, show up for a protest. It's going to be wild. And based on what we've already seen from the previous events, I think Trump is absolutely correct.
The time for games is over. The time for action is now. Where were you when history called? Where were you when you and your children's destiny and future was on the line?
Andy, let me start with you, only because you cover these extremist groups. Pretty powerful stuff. Is that a call to action?
No, yeah, it's a call to action. And let's remember, you know, this, there is not a disconnect between the Trump administration and these extremist groups. The Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers on January 6th, their leadership were in a mass text group with Trump's top confidant in Roger Stone. I mean, these people have full connection with Trump's administration. And so when these types of directives go out, you know, Trump and company can say all that they want. Well, I was just, you know, talking generally. I wasn't giving marching orders to these people. But the only people that they could be talking to are their direct allies in these extremist groups. And so absolutely they took it as marching orders and they got ready.
And Hugo, Andy mentioned Roger Stone. I'm also thinking of Michael Flynn. We see them at some of these rallies that that the committee posted yesterday. Trump also pardoned both of them. How do you see their role?
I think it's really complicated. I don't think we have the full picture of their connections yet. I mean, they share a lot of connective tissue, right? So, you know, Roger Stone is a self-declared member of the Proud Boys, but he also has connections to the Oath Keepers on January 5 and January 6. He was to be guarded by members of the Oath Keepers. Mike Flynn, meanwhile, who was also at this December 12 rally where he intersected with Stone, had his own paramilitary group guarding him. But again, he too was guarded by the Oath Keepers. And so the picture we start to get is of these three extremist groups guarding two of Trump's closest, I would say, external advisors. And so I think Andy makes a good point that while we don't have, you know, a direct link between Trump to Stone, to say, or to Flynn, to the rioters, there are these dotted lines. And if you follow them all the way through, I think you start to get a very clear picture of how conversations and flows of information might be happening.
And Andy, do we know how the Proud Boys view someone like Roger Stone?
Enrique Tarrio, as I wrote in my book, he is good friends with Stone on a regular basis. They've been together for the last 6 years, and Stone himself has been a sort of advisor of sorts to the Proud Boys. I mean, this is Enrique Tarrio, the chairman of the Proud Boys, is somebody that Stone took under his wing politically throughout his career. And so this is not something that can be, there's no plausible distance here, right? These guys are friends and allies, and certainly, you know, they may throw each other under the bus when the law comes calling, but we have a direct link between these guys.
We heard red wedding, you know, we heard other sort of, I guess, lingo back and forth. This all seems so obvious, Andy Campbell. I mean, it's all happening, you know, out in social media.
Right, right. Absolutely. And it's been happening for years. I mean, this is something, you know, where the rhetoric that comes from Trump is almost always immediately borne out in violence on the street. This is a president who has been inciting violent waves throughout his time in politics. And so, you know, these people were ready. This was not a random swell of violence. This was a crystallized group of extremists who thought that they had an ally in Trump and thought that they were given marching orders. And they've been doing this for a long time without any consequences. And so this was a natural culmination of the relationship Trump has with these extremist groups.
And Hugo, one question is, since this was sort of happening in public, at least on social media, is why D.C. was so unprepared and so unaware about what was going to happen on January 6th. Do we know?
I think that's kind of one of the other unanswered questions with respect to January 6th, right? I mean, the FBI field office in D.C. had been monitoring a lot of the chatter online and in kind of the social networks, but this never really filtered through to the rank and file and to the kind of the operational leaders at U.S. Capitol Police and for the D.C. Metro Police. And so I think there was a top level, you know, recognizance that there was something brewing, and you know, General Milley later said that, you know, he wanted to run through some operational readiness tests because they were concerned about what might happen on January 6th. But I think there was a disconnect between the fervor that the far right groups and these people spurred on by Trump's rhetoric were, and the kind of the political kind of group in D.C. who didn't really seem to latch on to the fact how ready they were to come to D.C. on the 6th.
Yeah, and you want to add to that, just sort of, you know, why? And we saw the violence, and we know the numbers of members of Capitol Police who either died or committed suicide, seriously injured as a result of this attack.
Certainly, and as more evidence comes forward in the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers sedition cases, we're learning that they had a plan in place to storm various D.C. buildings well prior to January 6th, and that law enforcement may have had a hand on that, or at least some knowledge that this was going to happen. And meanwhile, the committee showed that Trump himself had a draft tweet in which he was going to tell people to march to the Capitol after his speech at the Ellipse there. And so certainly they knew something was going to happen, something big was going to happen, and law enforcement was just not prepared. Nobody was prepared.
Well, and Hutchison had testified previously, I'll go back to you, Andy, that people were armed at the Ellipse where the president was giving his speech. He wanted them to come into the area that was closed off to them because they were armed, had weapons. So the president knew that people had weapons on them.
Yes, and a number of people around him at this last committee hearing showed concerns that there were going to be armed people, that there were going to be some of the most the loudest extremists in the game running the show before January 6th, and they aired those concerns and were just given brick walls. And so the crazy part is that not only did law enforcement know, but everyone around Trump knew what was about to happen.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and also just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We're talking about yesterday's January 6th committee hearing. Of course, it's number 7, so we have learned a lot over the last couple of weeks. Andy Campbell, senior editor at Huffington Post. He covers extremism and, again, author of a forthcoming book, We Are Proud Boys. Hugo Lowell is with us as well, congressional reporter for The Guardian, covering January 6th. And you can email us at radiotimes at whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking about yesterday's hearing, but obviously it's a bunch of hearings altogether that we are slowly beginning to make sense of. Let me play one more clip. We have several others after this. This is number 8. And this is committee member Representative Stephanie Murphy revealed that Steve Bannon spoke to the former president by phone on January 5th before warning his listeners to, quote, strap in the following day. Let's give it a quick listen.
The committee has learned from the White House phone logs that the president spoke to Steve Bannon, his close advisor, at least twice on January 5th. The first conversation they had lasted for 11 minutes. Listen to what Mr. Bannon said that day after the first call he had with the president.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's all converging, and now we're on, as they say, the point of attack, right? The point of attack tomorrow. I'll tell you this. it's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in.
Hugo, you're trying to piece this together, I know, for a story. What do we need to know about this?
Yeah, so if you look at the timeline between the two phone calls that the Select Committee revealed yesterday, based on the phone records that they've obtained from the National Archives, and then some of the messages that were being sent among the Proud Boy leadership that have come up in the DOJ superseding indictments, you can kind of see how this timeline fits together. And I think, you know, we've got to be careful to not draw direct links yet before right. we know the full picture. But certainly Steve Bannon speaking to the president for a good 10 minutes the morning of January 5 around 9 a.m. And then later in that afternoon, the Proud Boys are messaging each other saying, you know, we have a plan. I'm with, you know, Rufio, who's another member of the Proud Boys. You know, we're going to be able to rally everyone here together, and we're going to set into motion our plan for the 6th. Later that evening, Bannon goes back on his War Room show, his War Room podcast, and says, all hell is going to break loose. And then he has a final phone call with Trump around 10 p.m. on January 5. So January 5, you see a lot of conversations between the former president and Steve Bannon, who was then his, you know, still his chief strategist in exile, and simultaneously messages with the Proud Boys. And I think one has to wonder whether there was a link between those three. And when you triangulate, I think you start to see kind of a broader picture of what was going on.
And Andy, Steve Bannon was subpoenaed by the committee. He defied the subpoena. You know, he faces charges, I believe, next week. A judge said that he has to go. He wanted to testify before the committee. Do we know where that stands?
Not entirely, but I do love the posit by Bannon that he told Trump this isn't going to go how you think it's going to go. It's going to be a lot more violent. First of all, there's, you know, we have to take that with a grain of salt because Bannon, like a number of people here, are serial liars. But also, you know, there's no indication that Trump would have taken that advice and said, oh, well, then, you know, I don't want that. I mean, to this day, Trump is promising that if he becomes president again, he's going to pardon all of the January 6th rioters. And so I'm not sure that any of this advice going that way would have stopped Trump if it happened at all.
Let me talk about some text from Brad Parscale. Let me go back to Hugo for our listeners. Brad Parscale, what was his job with Trump?
So he was the former Trump campaign manager.
And he tweets to Katrina Pearson, who was Hugo?
Who was a January 6th rally organizer, mm-hmm. but also happened to be a former Trump campaign spokeswoman, I believe it was for the 2016 campaign.
So he texts this about Trump pushing for uncertainty in our country, a sitting president asking for civil war. This week, feel guilty for helping him win. She says back to him, you did what you felt was right at the time, and therefore it was right. And there are more texts from there. Hugo, what do we make of that?
I think it's just extraordinary, right? I mean, Brad Parscale is almost committing like a murder here. He's basically openly critical of the former president and pins the entirety of the blame for the Capitol attack and for the death of, it appears to be Ashley Babbitt, one of the rioters who died, squarely on Trump's shoulders. And then when Katrina says, you know, you do realize this is what's going to happen, and it wasn't the rhetoric, Brad Parscale messages her back and says, Katrina, yes, it was. Mm. And I think it just shows how Trump world and all of Trump's advisors knew exactly who was to blame. I mean, we saw Kevin McCarthy in the days after the Capitol attack, you know, again, blaming Trump. Everyone was blaming Trump. And it was only subsequent to that fact, months later, when it was politically expedient to distance Trump's responsibility from the attack, that they did so.
And I also read, Hugo, that he's now back with Trump doing something.
Yeah, they all seem to gravitate back to Trump one way or another. Again, same with McCarthy. And, you know, we were talking about Bannon earlier, and same with Bannon. I think Bannon immediately afterwards put a little bit of distance between himself and Trump and didn't really want to talk about January 6th. But, you know, when I caught up with him July last year, he was, you know, quite openly talking about his involvement with Trump and how, you know, they came up with this scheme to try and obstruct the certification through this kind of political gambit. And so it's quite telling, I think, the power that Trump has over these advisors. But I do wonder kind of the extent to which that happens because it's politically expedient. And so long as Trump is the head of the Republican Party and so long as Trump has the power to kind of shape Republican Party politics.
Andy Campbell, Paul has a question, sort of wondering what Merrick Garland is going to do. Now, you mentioned some Proud Boys are, they're facing some, what is it, seditious conspiracy charges.
Correct. And along with the Oath Keepers, so just taking a step back in the timeline really quick here, after about a year after January 6th, prosecutors were running a conspiracy case against the Proud Boys, and among the evidence put forth there was evidence that Enrique Tarrio, chairman of the Proud Boys, was holding a document in his hands on December 30th, prior to January 6th, called 1776 Returns, and it was a very detailed plan for the Proud Boys to occupy various buildings in D.C. on January 6th. Including House and Senate buildings. And so when that evidence came forward, we learned that not only did the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers have a, you know, outsized role on the day of January 6th, but we learned for the first time that there was tangible evidence that this was a planned attack. And so immediately when we saw that, we knew, okay, these guys are going to get seditious conspiracy charges, which means that you are accused of trying to overthrow the government with this plot of violence you have. And so going forward, you know, the prosecutors are trying to build a case to show, you know, not only did they, you know, commit violence that day, but they had a plan in place. And one of the very most interesting things I learned yesterday during the hearing, committee hearing, was they gave us that draft tweet that Trump never sent, but was about to, that said, hey, come down to the Ellipse at 10 a.m. and then we're going to march to the Capitol. And that, to me, Hugo, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I hadn't seen any evidence that Trump was going to tell people to march to the Capitol after his speech until that moment.
Well,
that shows some planning.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get the answer to that after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests about what we learned yesterday at the January 6th committee hearing. It was their seventh hearing. And again, talking with Hugo Lowell, congressional reporter covering January 6th for The Guardian, Andy Campbell, senior editor at Huffington Post who covers extremism. And again, you can join our conversation. We certainly want any questions or comments or observations you might have. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Hugo, if you can remember what Andy said right before the break about this tweet that was never sent, but I guess it does raise questions about just how much pre-planning was involved in the attack on January 6th.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to start with the 1776 returns document that kind of laid out those plans to occupy kind of buildings in D.C. I think prosecutors actually might have a bit of difficulty trying to mount this case because that plan didn't specifically mention occupying the Capitol. It kind of mentioned occupying kind of House office buildings, Senate office buildings. So I think that's kind of one wrinkle they're going to have to get over in that seditious conspiracy case that is not insignificant. But I think Andy's right about that draft tweet. Now, that draft tweet, we didn't see the date of it. So, and I think that's significant, right? Because if that draft tweet was to be sent, let's say, kind of 11 a.m. or kind of 9 a.m. on January 6th, when Trump had already put into his own mind that he wanted to go to the Capitol. And of course, previously we heard about how Trump tried to lunge at the steering wheel of one of the Secret Service, you know, inside his limousine so he could get to the Capitol and was making a big deal about this. That would kind of jive with his thinking. If it came before that, like if it came even like January 4th or like January 1st or December 29th, that kind of shows a much more extended planning timeline, and I think is much more significant because we're trying to establish how long before the Capitol attack did Trump know about the Capitol attack? And if he was planning to go to the Capitol, you know, even a week before, even days before, and hadn't communicated to this, first of all, that's significant. Second of all, how did Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal activist who had, you know, no formal ties to the administration or the campaign, know about this? Was this Trump telling him directly? Was it through an intermediary? I think these are all really interesting questions.
Wow.
And I think one of the themes and takeaways from the hearing yesterday was the committee gave us more questions than answers.
Clearly. Let me play another clip, and Andy, we'll hear from you. This is Jason von Tettenhove, former spokesman for the Oath Keepers. And here he is talking about the dangers the group presented and their drift to the far right. Let's give it a listen.
The best illustration for what the Oath Keepers are happened January 6th, when we saw that stacked military formation going up the stairs of our Capitol. I saw radicalization that started with my beginning of my time with them and continued over a period of time as the member base and who it was that Stuart Rhodes was courting drifted further and further right into the alt-right world, into white nationalists, and even straight-up racists.
And what we're hearing, or what we learned yesterday, Andy, is that there seemed to be at least some organization or some coordination between the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. How much do you think they were working together?
Well, I mean, I've been covering both of them for years. I mean, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers have been on a years-long, you know, sort of parade of violence throughout the country. The Proud Boys especially are coalition builders in the extremist space. And so they've been at rallies together. Their leaders know each other. And certainly they already bore a connection between through Roger Stone, because the leaders of both the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are, you know, longtime associates of Roger Stone. And so they certainly got together prior to January 6th. We know from one of the previous committee hearings that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers met in an underground parking garage on January 5th. And so there was these sort of like devious mob style meetings that happened prior. But certainly what that testimony showed, that the Oath Keeper testimony there, was that, you know, this was a pair of gangs that believed that they were running on Trump's marching orders and were there to win the day for him. And they had been ready and waiting for, you know, at least a month. I would say that after hearing that testimony, while it was gripping, one of the questions left on the table for me is that the committee didn't ask this former Oath Keeper directly, hey, what was your boss's connection to the Trump administration? Yeah. I think he had left the organization, you know, years before, but it feels like a gap that they didn't ask him, you know, directly, hey, what are your guys' connections to Trump? I really, really want to ask him that question.
And Hugo, what was your takeaway from this testimony from Jason von Tettenhove?
I think again, Andy makes a good point. I mean, so it's my understanding that Jason von Tettenhove left the Oath Keepers around 2016, 2017. And certainly we saw this incident that was raised in one of the DOJ's court filings about how the Oath Keepers leader, Stuart Rhodes, tried to get in touch with someone to connect him to Trump. And we also know he had previously asked the Oath Keepers general counsel, Kelly Sorrell, to put him in touch with Trump. So we know there wasn't a direct connection because he just didn't have it, but he was certainly trying to seek that. I think broadly, though, and I guess this speaks less to Jason von Tettenhove and more kind of the connections between Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, I did think it was significant, and this was previously unseen, was the fact that Kelly Meggs, one of the Oath Keepers members, called Enrique Tarrio of the Proud Boys hours after Trump's tweet. And then hours after that, Tarrio puts together his kind of insurrection group chat and handpicks members of the Proud Boys to start planning a DC operation. And so I think that was new evidence that we hadn't seen before. And I think is a new link, I believe, between Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys.
I mean, Andy, how worried should we be about some of these extremist groups?
Well, look, you've got their leadership sitting behind bars right now, awaiting sedition, their sedition trials, which this Proud Boys sedition trial starts in December. And we may get new bombshells about January 6th from that, because there are going to be Proud Boys testifying against one another. They've already agreed to do so. Wow. So it is going to be a super gripping case. But the issue with the Proud Boys, the issue with our extremism problem, is that January 6th was not a big bang. It was not a starting point for our extremism crisis. It was a stop on a long, you know, bus ride of extremism that began as Trump began his presidential campaign and has just continued along, firing on all cylinders. And it is, as I see it, beyond January 6th, the Proud Boys and other extremist groups have only ramped up their events in the streets. They're showing up at abortion rallies. They're showing up at, you know, civic events. They're showing up at school board meetings and harassing people. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think while these committee hearings are an acknowledgement of the extremism crisis, we have a long way to go to fixing it.
What do they want? I mean, broadly speaking, what do they want?
Broadly speaking, they want to be the enforcement arm of the GOP, and they want to present the violence that they commit as politically protected speech. And they've done that successfully by gaining power through people like Roger Stone, through their relationships with the GOP. I think 30 Proud Boys are running for office this election season, and you know, a number have already taken positions in various Republican parties. These are guys that are trying to make political violence the new normal and make political violence something that is part of constitutionally protected demonstration. And they've so far done a very good job at getting us there.
So when a Republican member of the House says they were tourists, or, you know, this was not an insurrection, or it was not as violent as people say, does that just inspire them even more?
Absolutely. And certainly, I mean, Republicans tried in the immediate aftermath to describe this as a random swell of violence that, you know, the Trump supporters, after Trump's rally, Trump leaves the stage and Trump supporters decided to go down there and fight at the Capitol. But now we're learning through these hearings that that's just not the case. This was a coordinated attack run by people who have been mobilized time and time again by the president and his allies throughout the years. And so what we're seeing is that this was planned.
Let me read an email from Ellen. I'll put this to you, Hugo. She says, suddenly the hearings are filled with former insiders who warned the president, disagreed with him, et cetera, et cetera. Where were they then? Frankly, the lack of integrity in the group is as disturbing as the insanity of the president himself. And I've heard other people being critical, essentially saying, well, where were you, you know, a year or even 2 years ago?
I mean, I think they raised a good point. I think a lot of these hearings, you're seeing a lot of these former administration officials, these former campaign officials coming forward and telling, you know, the truth, but only behind closed doors and only when they've been subpoenaed. And it's certainly true that they are doing a lot of reputation laundering and trying to clean up their image, a lot of CYA, as kind of a committee member kind of described it to me in recent weeks. And, you know, Pat Cipollone, the former White House counsel, said yesterday, well, we saw him say in his deposition, that he thought Mike Pence should get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I kind of turned to my colleagues and we all kind of thought the same thing, which was, well, you know, actually the vice president was just doing his job. The fact that he should get the Presidential Medal of Freedom for not helping overturn the results of a free and fair election, I think kind of speaks to how low the bar has become for stuff like this. The fact that, you know, we think doing your job now is worthy of high praise and kind of admiration and adulation. So I think that was significant, and it's been an interesting theme of these hearings. Thus far.
Well, let me play that clip. And this is former White House counsel Pat Cipollone praising Vice President Mike Pence's actions to certify the 2020 election results.
I think the vice president did the right thing. I think he did the courageous thing. I have a great deal of respect for Vice President Pence. I worked with him very closely. I think he understood my opinion. I think he understood my opinion afterwards as well. I think he did a great service to this country. And I think I suggested to somebody that he should be given the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his actions.
Let me go back to Hugo, because what we're learning is the intense pressure on Pence to not certify the election results. The mob was there essentially to find him and hang him or kill him or hurt him. So it wasn't sort of the usual, you know, pro forma certification of the results of an election.
Right. And this was kind of the Trump campaign and kind of the Trump White House's strategy all along, right? In a regular election cycle, when you reach the safe harbor date for the electoral count, for the Electoral Count Act, December 14, that's when the litigation stops. And that's when you normally say, okay, the states have sent their slates of electors to Congress, and, you know, that's that. Now it's just going to be a ceremonial certification. The Trump campaign and the Trump White House made a conscious decision, even from before the election, according to our reporting, to extend this all the way to January 6th, because they thought they could somehow obstruct that certification and return Trump to office by kind of claiming that states' powers exceeded that of kind of congressional authority. Yeah. And if the states decided to send an alternate slate of electors, then that, you know, ignore the will of the people. It's all about the state legislatures. And that was their whole theory, and that was the plan they were trying to advance. And by sending these fake electors, because they couldn't get the real ones, they were trying to dupe the vice president essentially into certifying the election for Trump. And this was the, you know, culmination of all of Trump's multifaceted plots to try and overturn the election. But then when it all came together on January 6th, you saw this explosion of this kind of political plan, and, you know, they was working in concert with what the extremist groups are trying to do, which was to stop that certification from taking place.
Andy, we have just a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye, but I just want to talk a bit about Stephen Ayers. He was the other person who testified yesterday. He had gone to the Capitol on January 6th. He had heeded the call from the president. He believed that the results were fake. What should we make of his testimony?
Well, look, I mean, I believe that there are a number of people who can legitimately say that they were duped by Trump's rhetoric. But whether or not they deserve a pat on the back for realizing that after the fact, you know, I don't know. But what I do know is that the end through line here is that we learned that people, like when Brad Parscale said, you know, Trump's rhetoric killed somebody. Yeah. These people knew and have known for a long time that Trump's rhetoric inevitably leads to violence, and they did nothing. And so when Mr. Ayers said that, you know, I'm looking at everyone around Trump who knew what his words would do. And there was a Twitter employee, an anonymous Twitter employee that they spoke to at the committee hearing who agreed that, you know, even Twitter, the platforms knew that his tweets were going to incite people to violence, and nobody did anything. And so when the witness says that, I'm looking at all of the people who knew and did nothing.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, Hugo. What you mentioned next Thursday evening. So what should we expect, at least as we know as of today?
Yeah, so the committee likes to change its plans and change its scheduling at a moment's notice. But at the moment, so yeah, we're expecting the final hearing of this series to come next week, Thursday, in prime time. So we would expect something like 8 p.m. That's what they did previously for the other prime time hearing. And this is slated to be about the 187 minutes of the Capitol attack and how Trump sat in the Oval Office and the White House dining room at various points, quite aware of what was going on at the Capitol, and refused repeatedly to send any sort of tweet or communication or address telling these people to leave the Capitol, despite, you know, members of Congress calling him, despite his White House chief of staff trying to talk sense into him, despite the White House counsel trying to speak to him. He ignored all of these entreaties and basically waited until late in the evening or the afternoon around 4 p.m. to issue his tweet saying everyone should go home. So that's the focus of the next hearing. There may be further hearings, right? This is still an active investigation.
Sure.
And a select committee member told me maybe at the end of August we see a second series of hearings.
Oh, very interesting. Hugo Lowell, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Congressional reporter for The Guardian. Andy Campbell, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, and thank you for having this conversation.
Absolutely. Senior editor at Huffington Post. He's got a book coming out in September, We Are Proud Boys. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.